KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So consider for a moment that process you go through to make a decision. Here's how most of us think it works. We see the things, we think about the things, we make the decision, and then we act. One, two, three, boom. But Guy Claxton says that's not really how it works. All of those acts, he says, are not strung out like different departments in a factory. They're all mushed up together in our bodies, and so when we do act, we actually didn't think about it all that much. Claxton says humans are built for action. The thinking part came later in our evolution. In his new book, he argues that we learn to use our gut as much as our brain to live our lives. His book is called Intelligence in the Flesh. He'll join us to talk about it after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The cognitive scientist Guy Claxton believes the human brain is getting too much credit for all the interesting stuff the human body does over a lifetime. Hegemony of the intellect is the fancy way he puts it in his new book. And our brains, he says, are amazing for sure, but Claxton says intelligence is so much more than just thinking. He says our real body, all of our body, the gut, the heart, the senses, get so little attention these days and so little skillful use. And just think about the way we talk about our bodies. We say we have a body. Claxton puts it differently. He says we are our body. And the difference is important. He explains in his book that most of us think our mind is the command center. It's supervising this concoction of dumb meat. But Claxton says it's the other way around. Here's how he puts it in his book. I am smart because I am a body. I don't own it or inhabit it. From it, I arise. Guy Claxton is joining us today to talk about the provocative ideas in his book called Intelligence in the Flesh. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Guy Claxton is a cognitive scientist and professor emeritus at the University of Winchester in England, where he founded the Center for Real World Learning. The full title of his new book is Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. And he's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in Brighton, England. Guy Claxton, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Thanks, Doug. It's a pleasure.
I guess we should begin by explaining that this latest book is part of a trilogy that you've been writing over the years, exploring human intelligence. Start there. What is it about human intelligence that interests you so much?
I've had a deep down feeling for a long time that there's more to intelligence than rationality. We know that rationality, clever lawyers arguing in a law house, can sometimes come up with results and conclusions that seem to the world at large to be rather stupid. On the other hand, we often seem to respond intelligently without doing a great deal of thinking. So I have been trying to puzzle away at this over the course of, as you say, a number of books.
I wanted to ask you about one of the most radical things you say in the book. And there are a couple of radical things you actually say in the book. But you write about from what we've been learning about the stories that societies have told themselves, the cultural beliefs that we've come to hold about human intelligence. You said we've come to now know that not only are the gods and spirits non-existent, but the unconscious is dead too. Explain what you mean, because this is a provocative idea.
Okay. This is in one of the earlier books, book called The Wayward Mind. I became very interested in the kinds of stories, cultural stories, that societies way back to the ancient Egyptians have told themselves in order to try and give an account of aspects of human experience or human behavior which seem wayward. Things like hallucinations, hypnosis, trance, things that don't fit with our normal commonsensical view of ourselves and therefore feel a little bit threatening to our identity of ourselves. So these stories try and tame those more wayward bits of ourselves and give at least the appearance of giving some kind of account of them. And there are roughly three different stories that recur throughout human history. There's a story which says, I behaved oddly because someone or something got inside me and made me behave differently. In other words, it was the gods or the devils or some exterior force that made me do it. And the second kind of story is that there's some deep, dark bit of my own mind that made me do it. That's the unconscious story. And then there are stories which say, maybe it's just the body doing its thing, which the mind is not so familiar with. And at the end of The Wayward Mind, I was saying that third kind of story seems to be not in the ascendant, but we're having to take another look at it and take it more seriously. And so the new book, Intelligence in the Flesh, is really trying to give that story, that way of thinking about the human mind as being closely tied to the body, to give that a run for its money and see how far we can take it.
Here's how you put it early in the book. You say, we neglect our bodies because we underestimate their intelligence. Now, we'll get at the particulars here in a moment, but what do you mean their intelligence? How can a corporeal body have intelligence?
Well, let me give you a little example about the neglecting. It's a paper I read recently. It's not actually in the book, but it would have been if I'd read it early enough. People differ in the way they think, you could say, but actually it's often unconscious, the way they deal with the relationship between mind and body. Some people think minds and bodies have very close relationships. Some people think their mind and their body are more distant. Now, if you try and push people towards their more distant way of thinking, that actually makes a difference to their behavior. So when they go off and have lunch, after they've had to describe a very dualistic view of themselves, they make worse choices. They make more unhealthy choices of the food that they select in the canteen. So the way we think about our minds, not just what our minds are, but the way we sometimes almost unconsciously think about them, the beliefs that we have about our own minds, have very direct impacts on the way we actually function. Now, if you think, you know, always choosing the fries and the sweet dessert, the ice cream and what have you, for me, that if you take a big picture of intelligence, that may be not so intelligent. So we need to be looking at not just at the mind and the body, but the way they come together and the way we think about their relationship.
You say that we're not neglecting our bodies because we're lazy or that we don't have willpower. But this is a matter of, again, this is one of these broader concepts I want to lay out before we get to the particulars. This is a matter of assumptions and values. Explain what you mean there, because these days we're really valuing what you describe as the cerebral jobs, kind of like the white collar jobs, I suppose, and the disembodied pastimes, like sitting there playing a video game. I guess this is one of those, rather than the physical and rather than the practical. That's the conflict here, I suppose.
If you look, a lot of my work is in education. And if you look, for example, at the relative esteem of subjects like mathematics or grammar, as compared with, I think, what in the States you call or used to call shop class, what we call vocational education, it's very clear that we esteem those different, I would say, forms of intelligence very differently. We reward more highly. We think of as more intelligent people who are good with words and paper, and often tend to underestimate, I think partly because we're looking through this sort of intellectual filter at the kinds of things that people do, we often underestimate the degree of real intelligence, subtle, sophisticated, cognitive decision-making that's going on in physical pursuits just as much, in hairdressing or playing football or someone who's a master electrician or plumber. When you look with fresh eyes at those activities, to me it's not at all clear that a really brilliant plumber is in any sense less intelligent than, for example, a kind of workaday academic delivering lectures in a college. So I think we need to just take a little bit of a fresh look at that.
The idea that this idea that intelligence is centered in the brain is a deeply now these days embedded cultural belief. Give us a sense, because you write about this in your book, how we got here, and maybe we should start with the Greeks.
Well, I think this idea that the intellect, and particularly the more rational, the more abstract, the more logical side of the intellect, epitomizes the height of human intelligence, goes back to the Greeks through the early Christians. It's been a strong strand through the development of the whole of what we used to call Western civilization, I suppose. And that leads to, there's a sort of blending together of the idea that the body is corruptible, is fallible, is connected with the passions or with the animal functions, and that our job is to try and transcend that into a world of what Plato would have called the eternal verities of geometry and logic and so on. Now, those accomplishments of the human mind are incredibly sophisticated. But as I put it in the book, you don't want to throw away your spade just because you've invented a scalpel. You need both. There's no need to look down on the poor old spade and say, what an inferior instrument. If you want to go out and dig your garden, a scalpel is not much use to you. So let's think more broadly about this. Obviously, you know, through Western philosophy, through Descartes and so on, this idea that the more abstract, the better, in a way, has informed our own view of our own minds. And the book is an attempt to try and just say, hold on a minute, poor old body, what St. Francis of Assisi referred to as brother ass, the poor old body gets a bit of a hard time, I think, and I think we ought to take a fresh look at it in the light of what's going on in systemic biology, looking at the way the whole body functions, and this new branch of science called embodied cognition. There are fascinating results emerging from the laboratory, which I think everybody would be fascinated by and really everybody ought to know about.
But before we move on from this part, I did want to mention a couple of particular points because it's intriguing. You mentioned, for example, Aristotle, who had this education system for boys, and boys were not allowed to pursue physical and mental training in the same year.
It's a symptom of the same attitude, isn't
it? Right,
because the physical training will contaminate your mental training.
Right. And then, of course, as you mentioned, Christianity adopts these kinds of attitudes, that these two processes are somehow, one is more corruptible, that they're separate. Descartes, you mentioned too. So I guess he was the one. As you put it in the book, he really succeeded in cleaving mind from body completely. And I guess in the West, anyway, this is where we're left. At least that Cartesian idea is one that you're saying we need to rethink. But it's embedded in our culture at this point, I guess.
Yes, it really is, and it seems to. I mean, there are always exceptions. Throughout our history, there have been groups or subgroups within, I mean, particularly within Christianity, throughout the history of Christianity, and today there are groups or strands within Christianity that take a very different attitude to the body, that have a much more celebratory attitude. And indeed, different religions have different views. Some religions see a much closer relationship, for example, between, this might take us off onto a completely different track, but between sex and spirituality. Right. Let's say, rather than putting them at the opposite ends of some kind of spectrum of esteem. So putting them back together is really worth having a think about, I think.
Yeah. So the thinking then was, as you put it in the book, and I mentioned this earlier in the introduction, this is how most of us have come to sort of see the way it works in terms of making a decision. We see something, we see the things, we think about the things, we make a decision about the things, and then we act. And this is how we think about it, that this is this sequence. But that is, in fact, not how it works. Would you take us through the way it actually works? Because I think this is an important part in thinking about how all of this, the body's intelligence, I guess.
Sure. I mean, this links into the conversation that we've just been having about the history, Doug. When people, in particularly in the 19th century, began to be uneasy with this strong dualism between mind and body, once you pull them apart like that, you have an obvious problem, which is how do they talk to each other? So dualism creates its own problems. When people were starting to question that, they thought, well, is there, instead of the mind being some kind of nebulous, ethereal consciousness that sort of floats above the physical matter, maybe the mind does have a physical home. And the first place they started looking for that home, fairly obviously, was the brain. They wanted to plop it into the brain. But what that, and indeed, our intelligence does have a very strong relationship with the brain. But we'll maybe talk a little bit about that as we go along. But the trying to locate it in the brain allowed us to continue to have that kind of apartheid between the intelligent and the unintelligent, except now we saw the intelligent as being only from the neck up, and everything else in the body from the neck down was servant, was menial, needed controlling and governing by what was going on in the brain. And I suppose one of the main strands that I explore in the book is the way the physiology now is telling us that that distinction between an intelligent brain and a servant body simply doesn't conform with what we know about the way we work, the way we're constituted. Brain and body are talking to each other constantly the whole time. And what that means is that perception, which is, as it were, part of the body, the special, the senses, and action, things that we do, our responses, visceral responses, as well as clever things that we do with our hands and our tongues, they don't, as it were, sit at the input and at the output of intelligence, with all the intelligent stuff going on in the middle, the thinking and the deliberating and deciding. Because the body and the brain are connected so tightly together, the way we perceive is already influenced by what we're expecting, what we're desiring, and by our own capabilities for action. So we have to look at our functioning as a much more intimately tied together, dynamically constituted constellation of perceptions and actions and thoughts and feelings, rather than this linear stretched out model, which doesn't really seem to do justice to what we now know about how we're made, how we're put together.
It makes you think more deeply about that term, follow your gut or use your gut, because this idea of intuition has seemed so ethereal. But it seems like there's something to it. I mean, there's something to this idea of, and we'll talk about thoughts and feelings a little bit later. But this idea of intuition seems to be a process, I guess.
It's a process, but this is a very good example of this rather crude opposition that has seeped into our mind, that intuition was seen as a kind of inferior way of knowing. Often, I have to say, somewhat shamefacedly as a male, stigmatized through history as a feminine or emotionally contaminated way of thinking about thinking. So that, you know, the male mind was, for goodness sake, was held up as being, you know, of the higher, occupying the higher ground of intelligence, which, as I say, is a rather shameful thing to admit now. Whereas... we now know from a lot of the research that intuition is absolutely crucial, is intelligent in its own way. For example, when the new Nobel Prize winners in science are announced. They're invited to go to Stockholm to accept their reward. This has been the case for many years. And when they go, they're asked if they'll take part in an interview. And one of the questions that they've been asked for many decades now is, what role do you think intuition has played in your academic journey, in your journey by anybody's standards at the higher reaches of intelligent functioning? And at the last count, something like 79 out of 84 of those icons of intelligence said, we couldn't have done it without our intuition. We couldn't have done it without waiting for that little hint, that little prompting. We have lovely words in the English language, don't we? Words like inklings. Right. And hunches. And they're saying, these people who we look up to as supremely rational and intelligent, they're saying, we followed our nose. We had to go and sleep on it. And then suddenly it seemed as if things were more clear in the morning, or as if understanding emerged essentially from a more holistic or more embodied way of thinking and feeling. Einstein himself said, my mechanism of thinking is largely composed of more or less clear images, many of which are bodily in nature. Well, if it's good enough for Einstein, it's good enough for me.
Right. So one thing that I've heard you describe, one way of describing it I've heard you say in the past, is it's almost like there are, we think of there being the brain as the sort of command center, but you describe it more as a chat room, and that it's not that the other systems don't have to work their way through the brain. Would you talk a little bit more about this, the way the systems sometimes speak to each other without really involving the brain almost?
Yes, the perspective that is so illuminating here is to look at the body not as an assembly of individual systems or organs. When I was at school and at university, the basic physiological textbook had different chapters. Everything was broken down. There's the circulatory system. There's the digestive system. There's the musculoskeletal system. And then there's the nervous system, which is divided into the central nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. And there's the lymphatic system and the immune system and so on. As if all these things could be discussed sensibly separately. But we now know that they are talking to each other constantly the whole time. The gut has its own brain. The heart has its own little brain, its own nexus of neurons. And the gut and the heart talk to each other. Muscles and organs in different parts of the body communicate with each other simply through the movements of the body. When I move at one bit of my body, the mechanical repercussions of that are felt in other parts of the body. So there's all kinds of electrical and chemical, which we've underestimated, and mechanical information systems. So we need to look at the body as a whole lot of information streams. Like my image is, if we could look into the body and light it up, it would be like a continual firework display of information sources firing off and communicating with each other directly. But one interesting piece of information is that the heart, for example, the healthy heartbeat is somewhat irregular. Not hugely irregular, we don't want to go in that direction, but somewhat irregular. And the unhealthy heart, heart disease, is predicted in part by an over-regularity, by a heartbeat that is too much, or in lockstep, like a marching army. And the reason why that's the case is because the heart needs to be constantly responding to what's going on in the other organs. It needs to be able to be flexible, to be elastic, in order to be, as it were, a good team member. It has to be listening to what's going on in the other organs of the body. So if the heartbeat becomes too regular, it's as if it's stopped listening. It's as if it's taken its headphones off and is just doing its own thing. And then we become more, we start to function more like that textbook model of the human body rather than the intelligent system, which is constantly chatting, talking, and interacting with itself. Some of that is crosstalk. It happens between the systems in the body. But obviously, we're such a complex system. And much of the time we need to act, not just in terms of the heart looking after itself and the lungs looking after themselves and the muscles and the gut looking after themselves, but we need to act as one. We need to act in concert, which is a good expression, because the concert orchestra needs somehow or other a central place where all the instruments can listen to each other. And that's why we have a brain. Not that the brain, as it were, is the intelligent manager or the chief executive of the body. It's simply the common room where all these different strands of information can send copies of themselves into this kind of central chat room where these conflicts can be, possible conflicts can be resolved and ironed out. Different bits of the body can talk to each other, and through conversation, not through somebody saying, this is the way it's going to be, guys, but through a more, what the old-fashioned word which I like is through a moot, through everybody getting together and sharing their ideas and thrashing it out. That's the way we achieve the most intelligent resolution. The answer to this, you know, the fundamental human question is, what's the best thing for me to do next? I think that's where intelligence springs from. And the brain is absolutely essential as the place where all these different subsystems can come together and have that conversation and come out with the best guess about what the best thing is to do next.
Guy Claxton is with us, a cognitive scientist, professor emeritus at the University of Winchester in England. His new book is Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rethinking the human brain. For years, science has suggested the brain controls the body. It's the command center. It's where intelligence and consciousness is centered. But Guy Claxton says that's not quite right. Claxton is a cognitive scientist, and he argues intelligence comes from the whole body, from the gut and the heart and the senses. He says we're spending too much time staring at screens and not enough time moving and making stuff. He's joining us today to explain what he means when he says we humans are built for action, not thinking. His book is called Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. And Guy Claxton is joining us from the studios of the BBC in Brighton, England. So we talked a little bit about how the intuition we get from our bodies is important. But surely complicated things like language and reason, those must be centered in the brain more than the body. But you say here again, not necessarily.
Well, it depends whether you're talking about language and reason as being in conscious experiences or whether we are acting in terms of language and reason. But anyway, let's have a quick look at language. Concrete language, the way language is represented in the brain is not like there's some little place, like those old-fashioned 19th century models of the brain, which says, you know, here is listening, here is seeing, yeah. And here is truth, and here is language, and here is thinking. Actually, even within the brain itself, the representation of language is smeared out across the whole brain. So when you hear the word hand, for example, you don't have to do, you're not supposed to do anything about it. You might just be having to make a judgment about whether H-A-N-D is a real word in your language or whether it's a made-up word. Nevertheless, the motor bit of your brain that represents the hand and the way it functions, that automatically lights up. There's not so it's not as if, you know, language detaches itself from the sensory motor aspect of our functioning. It remains continually attached to it. So if I put you in an MRI machine, which enables me to look at what's happening in your brain. And I show you sentences like John grasped the hammer. And again, all you have to do is judge whether it's a grammatical sentence. Mm-hmm. In the very process of judging whether that's a sensible sentence or not, the bit of your brain that readies itself to grasp, to make a fist, to make your hand close in on itself as if it were grasping something, that automatically lights up. It's as if the brain can't stop itself. The more interesting thing is if the sentence that I gave you was John grasped the argument or Mary took your point. Now, those usages are metaphorical. They've drifted away from the physical act of grasping. And we use the word grasping to refer to a much more rational or mental kind of process. Nevertheless, if I look at what's going on in your brain through the lens of an MRI machine, when you're trying to figure out whether John grasped the argument is a well-formed sentence of your language, that same bit of your brain that is to do with your hand closing and making a fist, it lights up too. For no obvious reason. It's as if the visceral roots of language remain connected with the more abstract aspects of our thinking. Even mathematics, even mathematical thinking, according to a fascinating book called Where Mathematics Comes From by Lakoff and Nunes, even mathematical thinking, up to a pretty high level, differential calculus, for example, you can trace back to very concrete physical experiences and metaphors. And in their book, they analyze why, for example, things like differential calculus are so tricky for students to learn when they get into high school, up into, 10th, 11th, 12th grade. What they've diagnosed is that they're difficult to understand because we've grown up with the wrong physical metaphor of what a line is, for example. And I won't go into the details of it, but if you shift the physical underpinnings of our understanding, then something like calculus becomes easier to understand. So again, through a whole range of things that we thought was the intellectual high ground, still seems to have, like the lotus flower, it has its roots in the mud of our concrete physical experience. And I don't know about your listeners, but I find that absolutely fascinating.
I do too. For me, one of the most interesting parts of the book was the section where you explore how deeply interconnected our bodies are to the material world, which means the tools and the space around us being part of that expression of intelligence. And it puts a new kind of, at least for me, perspective or a deeper kind of sense to this idea of having a craft. A hobby for getting dirt under your nails. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's an important theme in the way you're thinking about all of this.
Yes. I mean, the first expansion, if you like, of the idea of intelligence that I talk about in the book is expanding it from this abstract bubble to include the processes going on in the body. But it's actually worse than that, because we need to expand not just to include the body, but beyond the body as well. When you look at someone learning to use a tool, it might be a monkey learning to use a little plastic rake to drag a peanut through the bars of its cage so that it can get hold of it. And you look at what's happening to the way the body is represented in the brain, the way we map the limits and the structure, the shape of our body. Amazingly, within a few minutes of learning to use this tool, the representation of our body, of our physical being in our brains, expands to include the tool itself. Right. So as far as the monkey is concerned now, its body doesn't end at its fingertips, it ends at the end of the rake, just as the blind person's white stick becomes part of their body. The pencil, when I'm writing, it's as if, you know, I'm not conscious of my body stopping at the end of my fingers. The pencil, the pen, the stylus becomes a part of my very physical body. In the old days, interestingly enough, we used to use that expression. There's a lovely old English expression when you say you meet a woman who's got a new hat or a new flamboyant dress, you would say, that hat becomes you, my dear. And the truth is, it really has become you. Because in the old days, people wearing large flamboyant hats, once the hat had been on their head for a few minutes, they wouldn't knock it when they walked through a low doorway. They would just, without thinking, automatically duck or adjust. Wow. As if the hat was a integral part of their own body. Even our vehicles, we talk about we're driving along the road, we say, you know, my back wheels hit the curb.
Right.
My back wheels? When I looked down, the last time I didn't have any back wheels, but I come to think of myself and the car as being the functional intelligent unit. So intelligence begins to spread out into the world around us. It doesn't even stop at the surface of the skin. It becomes a bit spookier than that.
Mm. When we get back from a break, I want to talk about how it is you, because you write about this, how it is you can teach people to use their embodied intelligence and this idea of moving interoceptive awareness. This is really interesting. We'll talk about it when we get back from a break. Guy Claxton is with us. His book is Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Guy Claxton. We're talking about his book, Intelligence in the Flesh. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in Brighton, England. So how do you teach this? Because you say for the body to be at its most intelligent, it has to be properly strung. Explain what that means.
There's a bunch of research now which shows that the quality of the decisions that we make in real life settings relies on a whole lot of past experience. We meet a situation that is a little like, but not exactly like, a whole bunch of stuff that's happened to us in the past. And the extent to which we are available, the extent to which we are aware of what happens in our body when we reactivate those echoes of our own history, influences the intelligence of the decisions that we make. What's called technically what we might call gut feeling, but it's technically called our interoceptive awareness.
Yeah.
The extent to which, for example, someone can accurately count their heartbeat without actually putting their hand on their pulse. So how aware are we of what's going on inside us? Turns out to be a predictor of the intelligence of those decisions that we make in complex real-life situations. This has real practical repercussions. So people who are more alien, whose bodies are more alien, mm-hmm. who don't feel the delicacy of the moving of our feeling or an intuition or a hunch or a sense of attraction or revulsion, those little emotional currents that are moving around inside our bodies all the time. People who are more insensitive to those seem to be denying the chat room in the brain vital information. It's as if those processes may be going on, we may be being reactivated at a visceral level, but if those echoes, those resonances are not, as it were, taking their place at the top table, at the discussion room in the brain, if they're excluded from that high-level discussion, which is where consciousness seems to emerge from, then it's as if we're denying ourselves important sources of information. People who are depressed, for example, tend to have lower body awareness It's as if they're withdrawing from what's going on in their body. These are broad generalizations, but there's evidence to support this.
Wait, I wonder,
at the same time, they're also their ability to make decisions diminishes. So there's a very direct relationship between our bodily awareness and the intelligence of our functioning.
I want to underline that because this part of the book was fascinating. When our interoceptive awareness is muted, as you just said, we have a more difficult time making decisions.
Hmm.
And as you mentioned, people who suffer from clinical depression, they are, as you put it in the book, poorer than average at monitoring their own heartbeats.
Hmm.
I liked that particular bit of business because it says that that really gets to the fact that these people are, and maybe it's a generalization, but they're not necessarily paying attention to what's going on inside. They're not hearing that heartbeat, as it were, paying attention to those particular key points.
Yes.
Right? And, in your body.
Yes. And that opens up an interesting train of thought for me as an educator, which is whether, with the best will in the world, we have, by the way we've set up our schooling, sit down, be quiet, mm-hmm. don't move, pay outward attention, whether we've actually been training people out of this delicate visceral awareness rather than into it, and as it were encouraging people to draw their attention up only into the realm of the abstracted, the verbal, mm-hmm. the symbolic, which is crucially useful, but it's not the whole deck. It's like you're trying to play the game only with the spades and you've neglected the clubs and the hearts and the diamonds. That seems to open up for me some really deep and interesting questions about our social institutions and the way, particular interest to me is education, the way in which this view of this split view of ourselves, this disdain for the physical and the bodily, has worked its way into our public institutions to the detriment perhaps of people's real life functioning.
Well, this is an important part of you kind of come around to this in the book, the idea that maybe we use what we're learning then about the whole body as a way of redesigning our social structures, religion, medicine, government. Why, for example, do we make children stand still, as you were just referring to? But you also asked an intriguing question in the book. Why is it that we've set up this adversarial form of jurisprudence and government? Mm. I mean, a lot of the structures that we've come to take for granted, democratic processes, for example, are based on this dissonance between the body and the mind, it seems.
Yes, the body doesn't get a look in many of our decision-making forums, in parliament, in courts of law, and so on. Whereas in many other cultures, I mean, a lot of what I'm working my way, perhaps rather laboriously, towards in this very rational book, I have to say, a book that draws a lot on science, is perhaps a revalidating of not the whole thing, but of some aspects of what we might have dismissed as traditional or indigenous forms of wisdom in other cultures, where the body perhaps had a larger role to play in thinking and decision making. I mean, one strand of research that illustrates this in the book is the role of gesture, mm-hmm. of physical gesture. We seem to treat gesture as if it were somehow just ornamentation or ancillary, just decoration to the intelligence of our tongues and our pens and our conscious minds. But actually, if you make children sit on their hands so they can't gesture, their level of understanding, for example, of mathematical or logical operations, seems to be less. Mm. We need our hands. We need to talk with our bodies. Which raises the intriguing question of why cultures that are more flamboyant in their gesturing do or sometimes don't seem to be any more generally intelligent than the rest of us. And I haven't figured that one out yet. you know, I would love to be Italian because the gesturing seems to be more uninhibited.
Yeah.
but whether decision making in Italian cultures is more rational than others, I don't know. I better not go there.
Well, how about go to happiness? Are people who use gestures and if they're less inhibited with their hand gestures, with the use of their bodies, are they happier?
That's a really good question, and I don't know. I don't know. The research on that.
Yeah.
Certainly, there's a link with creativity. The studies of children's gesturing, these fascinating studies by a researcher called Susan Golden Meadow and her team in the States, have shown that if you look really carefully at the way children are gesturing as they try and explain something to you, might be a logical operation or what have you, if you allow them to gesture and look carefully at their gestures, and analyze them, their gestures often, if you look really carefully, often give evidence of a child's higher level of understanding or the child being on the brink of making a breakthrough to a more intelligent or more comprehensive or more mature level of understanding than their words, their tongues and their pens give evidence of. It's as if when we are allowed to gesture, our gesturing has a lower threshold for acceptance of our thinking, of our ideas, than our tongues and our pens do. It's as if when I say something, I require a higher degree of confidence in order to be able to declare it, whereas my gesturing might be giving evidence of a kind of leakage of something that is more interesting, more advanced, more speculative. And in my common sense view of things, more intelligent than simply what's coming out of your mouth.
We're running out of time, and I wanted to get to some of the... You go through a couple of particular ideas of how we can, as you put it, get our bodies back. I wanted to go through a few of these. Let's talk about... You mentioned biofeedback as one, mindfulness, meditation, that's another one. Let's talk about focusing. How do we develop this idea of focus? Because this concept of intelligence in the flesh, that's what that is. It's this sensitivity and bodily awareness. But how do you develop that?
Well, it's the line of thought that we were pursuing a little while ago about whether you've damped down or muted your awareness. Obviously, the flip side of that is, can you expand it? Can you get it back? Can you intensify it? And there are various forms of well-documented practice which now show that learning to cultivate, learning to listen to the still small voice in the part of your body that houses your major organs, for example, that houses your heart and your lungs and your liver and your gut, learning to be more sensitive to those actually helps us understand ourselves better. It augments our creativity and helps us understand other people better as well. So one of these practices, actually I've recently been in upstate New York at a week's international summer school on focusing. It was originally devised by a very interesting, now pretty elderly chap called Eugene Gendlin, who for a long time was at the University of Chicago, both a psychotherapist and a very interesting philosopher, who has shown that people who tend to be making progress, for example, in counseling or in therapeutic situations, as opposed to people who just seem to be spinning their wheels and getting stuck and telling the same old story, people who are making progress are people who talk in a particular kind of way. They talk as if what they were saying was an attempt to capture something that is going on in their bodies.
Yeah.
It's as if they say something and then they listen to what they've said and they say to their guts, to their inside, was that right?
Yeah.
Did that really capture it? Did I get that right? And what Gendlin and his colleagues have discovered is that we're very sensitive to that. So if it's not quite right, if what you're saying doesn't do justice to a more embodied form of understanding, you get a kind of And you get a kind of feeling inside, not quite it, if you're sensitive to it.
Right.
If you're not sensitive to it, you'll settle for it. You'll settle for the same old story, and then you go round and you tend to go round and round in circles. Whereas if you get it just right, there's often quite a physical and mental and emotional process of release. There's a feeling of, that's it. Mm. Yeah, that's it. A feeling of a kind of, almost Jendlin says, it's like listening to the child in your chest.
Right.
As if a child who's not very articulate finally has their needs heard by a perceptive and patient parent, for example. I mean, these are metaphors, but it's a way of trying to capture what that feeling is. And Jendlin describes this teachable process of focusing as learning to allow your attention to almost seep back down into your body. He says often we've learned to be in a hurry. Our thoughts come to us, they bubble up from a more holistic sense of ourselves, which includes the body, but they don't just bubble up. It's like we shoot to the surface, we leap to conclusions, we neaten things up, and then we live in that world of neatened, languaged, talked about kinds of things, and we make progress, we become more intelligent and more creative and more perceptive, and we allow growth in ourselves to happen more if we learn the trick of slowing down, going inward, and saying to ourselves, you know, what's that whole thing about, that whole thing with my mother or my job or where I'm living or whatever it might be, and then wait quietly and patiently, like sitting quietly by the edge of a pool on the seashore. When you first sit down, you don't see anything. But if you wait patiently and quietly, the crabs begin to come out. The little creatures begin to make themselves known to you. And it's like that process. But if we're in a hurry, if we're stomping around in our own inner world, so to speak, then we don't see, we don't get those precious inklings and intimations of something more, something deeper, something truer. And if we allow ourselves to do that, then I think in anybody's terms, we're smarter.
Guy Claxton, his book is Intelligence in the Flesh, Why Your Mind Needs Your Body Much More Than It Thinks. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in Brighton, England. Guy Claxton, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Lindsay Vickers is our intern. Josh Weathers is producer for Video West. Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.